I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Every now and then, you just want to have a long conversation with somebody who has written beautiful books and has a lot to say about politics and children and presidencies. And so we're going to do just that this hour. Ron Suskind is our guest. It's been many years since I've chatted with him. And I thought about him recently because he's co-host now of a new podcast, Freak Out and Carry On, from WBUR. And it looks at current events through the lens of history. Ron is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and best-selling author. He was the Wall Street Journal's senior national affairs reporter from 93 to 2000, contributor for the New York Times Magazine, for Esquire. His books include, most recently, Life Animated. You may know about this story because it made national news, and then it went to the Academy Awards. It's a story of sidekicks, heroes, and autism, and it's about his son, Owen, a boy with autism, nominated, as I said, for an Academy Award in the documentary category this year. He has written, Ron, so many, and if you haven't read any of his books, I highly recommend them. He's a very gifted writer. Early on, he wrote A Hope in the Unseen, An American Odyssey from the Inner City to the Ivy League. He wrote The Way of the World, A Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism, The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11, Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President, The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill. As we talk about all kinds of subjects this hour, we welcome your phone calls, and the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is ideas@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Hello, Ron. How are you?
Hey, Kathleen, what joy to hear your voice. It has been a couple of years. I guess we didn't do a round with Life Animated.
I know we didn't. And I saw the Academy Awards and your son and your family, and I was moved to tears by the whole thing, and I thought, darn, I should have talked to him about that book.
It was quite a day. I mean, you know, the story has been, you know, circling the globe for a couple of years now. The book originally came out in 2014. Which is really the story behind all those other stories that people know. We didn't really talk about this in my family, but at the beginning, 20 years ago, we all changed when our son Owen was diagnosed with autism, just shy of his third birthday. And in some ways, looking back, I became a different person, the whole family. Mm. We all changed, and a better reporter, a better thinker. Owen forced us to ask a different set of questions that made us all better, as my wife says.
So. Yeah. Well, you were already a pretty darn good reporter, so you must have become just superb after that.
Well, you know, it was so much fun going to the Academy Awards because, you know, the short version of the story is that Owen lost speech around 3, late onset autism, about a third of all the kids. Mm. And now, you know, it's 1 out of 42 boys now are in the autism spectrum.
Really?
In the United States. It's quite stunning. Yeah, 1 out of 68 children total. It's 5-1, boy to girl. And he's silent for years until we realize that he's memorized 50 Disney animated movies, starting with Snow White, the first feature in 1937. And if you throw him a line, he'll throw you back the next line. And all of a sudden we said, oh, my God, we can communicate in Disney dialogue.
Yes.
Which is what we do every night. While I'm interviewing presidents by day, by night, we're all playing out characters from Sword and Stone and Jungle Book and Beauty and the Beast. In the basement, over years, he gets his speech back. He learns to read by reading credits and emerges as a teenager into, like so many folks on the spectrum, a unique individual. With deficits, but also these powerful compensatory strengths. And the last thing I'll say, just in terms of how this fits to everything else, is that we realized looking back, Cornelia and I, my wife and I, is that when Owen was diagnosed, I changed as a reporter. Before that, I was a more traditional stripe, a little more gotcha in the mix. But at that point, I began looking for left-behind people in the world, in inner city America, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in all sorts of places that are forgotten. And of course, the most dramatically left behind person I knew was living in the bedroom, our son, who was silent and deemed on his way to institutions, uneducable. And in some ways, all those characters that people know from all the books and all the journal stories, the stuff on television, are really kindred of Owen, our guy. He's now 26, and now is known around the world.
He sure is.
Precisely who he is.
And I have an image of his face at the Academy Awards. He was one happy young man.
Oh. He was in heaven.
I can't bet he was.
One of the things that's so crazy about it is, you know, we have lots of friends who are neuroscientists these days because we're kind of changing the way autism is being treated. They say, look, neuroplasticity is a big, giant concept. It's almost as big as Einstein and relativity. It means the brain is constantly reshaping itself, finding new ways to adapt and to do what it needs. And that means for every deficit, the brain hacks a solution, finds an equal and opposite strength. And that's the way we all are. Just folks in the spectrum are very dramatic versions of that. So my question always when I see a person on the spectrum is, where's the compensatory strength? Find it and feed it. And all of a sudden, you have these extraordinary expressions of human capacity.
Hmm. Why Disney? What captivated him about all of those films, Ron?
Well, you know, we asked Disney about that. They asked us about it, actually.
I imagine.
I think part of it is that it's both image and music. The characters are vivid in their expressions of the basic human emotions. The scenes are such, as Walt Disney said with the first movie, Snow White, I want people to understand this movie with the sound off. I want it to be so clear in terms of situation, in terms of plot, in terms of character, that they can understand it no matter whether they speak English. In those days, they didn't translate movies into every language, and Walt was thinking of the globe back in the 30s, a little early for general thinking. And of course, that's perfect for folks with social, emotional, or language or deficits. That's one thing. The other thing is that there's so much emotion wrapped up in all of those movies. You know, look, everything's in a Disney movie somewhere. And if you look at them all together, you've got pretty much the whole landscape. So that was a good pick for him to embrace Disney as his affinity. But here's the thing we've learned, is that folks in the spectrum do this no matter what their passion is. Mm. For years, the view was these passions were obsessions, since the 40s, since autism is first identified. And they're things you either cut them off or maybe use them as a behavior tool, but don't feed them. And that's been reversed. They're not prisons, they're pathways, and often pathways to extraordinary lives. And so a few years ago when the book came out, Cornelia and I got together, and we actually started a virtuous enterprise called Sidekicks, which really brings technology to individuals like us and our son to help them untap this potential and use their affinities no matter what they are.
Oh,
Disney, I can do any voice you want.
I'll bet you can. And so, so can Owen. And does he still watch the films? Is he still captivated?
He does. He does. We wondered, as his older brother said at one point, hey, Dad, is it always going to be Disney forever? I said, I don't know, buddy. It could be. But Owen uses it as his foundation, but he's migrated to live action. I'll tell you one very, very short anecdote which says it all. He broke up with his girlfriend, which is something you see in the Academy Award-nominated film. It's quite a moment. And it's been rough since then. And at one point, he was kind of down in the dumps, and Cornelia and I said, hey, buddy, are you able to use any of your movies to help you here? Mm. And he's like, you know, the Disney movies are not that helpful. they all end in the same way. Boy gets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back. boy loses girl credits. That's a more of a European-style movie. And so he said, there is one movie that's helpful. And we said, what? He said, the Christopher Nolan Batman series.
Oh, my
God. And
goodness.
I'm like, oh, brother.
What's the problem? Oh, no.
And he said, it's a scene. Owen's a big fan of the Sidekicks, you know. They help the heroes fulfill their destiny. He's an aficionado of Sidekicks. And at one moment, Bruce Wayne is at the bottom of a deep pit. Wayne Manor is burned to the ground. And he's there with Alfred, Michael Caine. and he's feeling like all is lost, Bruce Wayne is. And Alfred says, and Owen does this at the kitchen table, much better than I can in Michael Caine's voice. He says, "Why, sir, do we fall?" And Bruce Wayne says, "Why?" He says, "So we can learn to pick ourselves back up again." And Owen says, "I hear this scene in my head when I wake up, and it helps me get through the day."
Oh.
And that's, you know, what we all do with art and with cinema,
right,
with literature, with these expressions of humanity that we embrace. They help us see ourselves like a mirror, a map, a code breaker to who we are as humans,
right,
as people. And that's what he does, like everybody. Just he has to do it more dramatically and just to rely on it in ways that the rest of us.
Exactly. Oh, my, that thought will stay with me. And were you a Disney fan, too, or was all of this kind of new to you when you started learning all the parts?
You know what, guy? Like, as a kid, I embraced what would be called the modified American Disney plan. You know, I watched the movies that came out when I'm a kid. That, for me, I'm 57, so that's Sword in the Stone and Jungle Book. That's the 60s. Went to Disneyland when I was 12 in 1971, when it just opened. But that's about it. Left it behind. I read Joseph Campbell and other scholars of myth and fable saying, you know, the putting myth and fable into the kids' department is nonsense. No culture does that. We seem to here. But that's it. But then Owen brought us around because we couldn't connect with him in any other way. And what's really interesting is that it all ties back to what, of course, I've been doing for decades, which is looking for stories,
right,
around the world,
mm-hmm,
telling them, writing them, trying to breathe life in them, and then letting them free to go out and have relationships through books. And they do, in fact. I find that, you know, I'm 6 books along now, and I bump into people who read one book or the other. And they're a little like children. My wife says, "Look, honey, this is as close as you're going to get to childbirth, creating a book. You might as well enjoy it." You know, but they are like children. They go out, these books, you let them go. They have relationships with people. They spend time with them. And they find their way into the world, which is what all the books have done.
Yeah. Now I remember why I like talking to you so much. Yeah, it's
and
good.
I love talking to you, Kathleen.
All
I
right.
mean, Micah, how many years, what are we talking here? How many years have you been doing this thing you do?
Well, I'm retiring next Thursday.
I know.
I know. So I've been doing radio for 44 years, which is incredible. And I've been here for 24 years.
Wow.
It's a long time.
Well, you have created a beacon. You truly have. You're one of the stops on America's cultural and intellectual journey.
You've
got to see Kathleen as part of what you do.
You're very kind. I didn't think I was going to get weepy about all of this, but then I woke up in the middle of the night last night and I thought, "Oh, I'm retiring. What the heck? I'm not sure."
Yeah.
I'm getting a therapy dog, so I keep, you know, his face is in my mind, and I'm going to teach him how to, you know, go to hospice and schools and maybe work with autistic kids as well. And I've met him, and now I just keep thinking of him. I have his face in my mind and his spirit, and I'm going to get him right after I retire, so it'll be a whole new life. But what a new life it's going to be. It would be like if you started, you know, you got a dog and you stopped writing or doing your podcast. And I woke up in the middle of the night thinking, whoa, this is significant. I didn't think it was significant until the middle of the night last night. And then I thought,
Well, you know, Kathleen, you're a kind of person. I think I'd probably be in this category, too, where kind of what you do is who you are.
Right.
Everyone is in that category, as we know. And so it's different for you to move out of this stage of your life into something else. I mean, I don't think, as you, of course, you know, you won't cease to be just like you are now. The question is, how will you express all these muscles you've built over the years of how to see people, how to get inside of them, how to draw from them their essence? You know, you're super skilled. You're about as good as they get at that, and you'll keep doing that forever. In I'm sure all kinds of amazing ways.
Yeah, I just don't know what they are. But thank you. Now you're making me want to move on. I'm uncomfortable with praise, but thank you.
I'll tell you, I did a little pivot here. I mean, I still do what I do, and I write, and I do my podcast, and I spend time building this thing for autistic kids.
I know.
And it's called Sidekicks. Go to sidekicks.com. It's
okay.
A free app.
Okay.
To help parents. And they're doing it now. It's on the App Store. It was a little different. Again, I didn't stop doing what I've been doing for years, but just using my capacities here did open some new pores for me. And you'll do that, I imagine, dramatically now.
I am absolutely flabbergasted. I didn't realize that the numbers, 1 in 42 boys,
isn't that amazing?
That's significant, isn't it?
It is. It is. And it's in part because our understanding of what autism or the spectrum is has grown to include many more folks who might have been in different categories. But the general thinking is that it's a combination of that and probably some sort of trigger that's creating this particular presentation of capacities and challenges throughout the population. Look, it's no different in South Korea than it is in America. So
really?
It's not something rooted, I think, in the landscape, if you will. But I think the other thing that we're leading in terms of our efforts is something that actually I did with inner-city African-American kids back when with my first book, is
right.
to say, you know, look for things that are out of format. You know, this may not, what they're able to do may not fit with your yardsticks. But those yardsticks are bent and often inappropriate to measuring the great flora, the great diversity of human capacity. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're having more and more happen with folks on the spectrum. They don't fit well into one-size-fits-all models, but frankly, those things are collapsing anyway in this age of powerful information going everywhere, of people being able to self-nourish from early ages on all available knowledge, and people being more self-directed, I suppose. And I found that often, you know, my first book with Cedric Jennings, with kids in a blighted urban terrain of Washington, D.C.,
right.
You know, they were living mostly crowd control in their neighborhoods and in their schools, and they would find something that spoke to them, and they would dive deeply into it. And the capacities they showed through that telescope, through that area of passion, was often extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't do them much or serve them well in the way we measure, and I think measure in a clumsy fashion. Human capacity and transactional value in the society. And in some ways, interestingly, my first book, A Hope in the Unseen, and my last book, Life Animated, meaning Cedric Jennings, the kid who went from the blighted urban terrain, dad in jail, mom once on welfare, to Brown University, and Owen, my son, are being twinned on the landscape.
Oh,
Cedric,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, Cedric separated from a life of possibility by bad luck at birth, by all the things we know about bigotry and racism. Owen, by the hand he's dealt neurologically.
Yes.
But both of them seeking the unseen, in a way, these larger lives of possibility.
Mm. Ron Susskind is our guest, and he's also doing a podcast. We'll move into conversation about the president's first 6-plus months in office. It's a relatively new podcast, and they do what's going on currently in politics and look at it through a historical framework. So if you had to fill in the blank here, Donald Trump's presidency is most like who's in history. We'll talk about that with him, what he expects from the next 3 years. Anti-immigrant sentiment in the United States, we'll move into political topics. But feel free to talk to him about autism as well, because he's really... His story, his son's story, his family's story is all over the world right now because of the documentary and his book. But Ron, when he described what he's done with books, he does them in all of them. He's a very gifted writer and is well worth reading for political bents and also for the story of human lives. His new podcast is Freak Out and Carry On from WBUR in Boston, and worth a listen. So we're going to welcome phone calls, okay? Be it autism or politics, whatever, or any of the books that he's written, we are opening phone calls. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is ideas@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. Let's go to phone calls for Ron Suskind. We go to Stephanie in Madison. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi, Ron. And Kathleen, I'm going to really miss you. Really, really miss you. And I'm going to try not to get too emotional here. But, Ron, I just want to say to you and your family and your son, thank you for who you are, for sharing, for writing about your son, for you know, all of you being so open. I am a person who's become blind, and I'm dealing with it pretty well. Had you know, vision issues all my life. And what you're doing is you're reframing the whole thinking about, and I can't think of a word better than disability right now, but we'll come up with the language. The big thing anybody wants, we want to be part of humanity. You want your dignity. Nobody wants pity. Nobody wants to be like an exotic representation. We just, you know, you want to be with other people and you want to be accepted. And your work and your son's work and you're going to help us come a long way to getting where we want to go. Hopefully dealing with the prejudice and the low expectations that people have of people with disabilities. It's a road that you have to go with a lot of patience and a lot of perseverance. But anyway, I'm going to just hang up and listen, okay?
Thanks, Stephanie.
Thank you, Stephanie. I'll say I'm moved by your words, as I have been by the outreach and the expressions of people all over the world since we got involved 3 years ago, almost in this book and the movie. And, you know, there was a term that I heard years ago called differently abled, as a replacement for disabled. And back when I thought it was just kind of a PC term, and I tended to push back against PC terms as an investigative reporter type guy. Where's the evidence for that kind of thing? But now I realize that is the appropriate term. You know, obviously there are people who suffer and wrestle with deep challenges that profoundly limit and wrongly limit their lives. But what I've learned from many folks who are tagged as disabled is what differently abled truly means. They say to me, as they did years ago, they say, well, you see Stevie Wonder or Ray Charles, you've seen them for years, of course. They have all sorts of compensatory gifts. They can do anything with sound. And here's a guy in a wheelchair with huge, dexterous, muscular arms, all compensations for the struggle. And, of course, that's always what makes us best as humans. You know, what's that line from Shakespeare? Sweet are the uses of adversity, which, like the toad, ugly and venomous, bears a jewel in its forehead. Imagine you like it. I think what I have found in the many folks who are differently able to have taught me is their extraordinary capacity to find the jewel. And that has made my life and the life of my family better. And I think that's a recognition that is growing here and abroad, just by hearing words like yours, Stephanie.
Thank you, Stephanie, for the call. Was it hard? Was all this international attention hard for your family, and particularly hard for Owen? All of a sudden, there, you know, he's at the Academy Awards, the cameras are on, everybody's interviewing everybody, and he's getting attention from everywhere. Was it too much?
Not in the least.
He liked it.
we worried about it. Cornelia, as you know, if you saw her in the movie or the book, you know, is a ferociously protective and a powerful presence. You know, if any of this had bad effects on Owen, you know, it was stopped. You know, in a way, Kathleen, he is unencumbered by some of the burdens of the rest of us, like a doubt in front of big crowds, or, oh, that's not my good side. I should have worn the purple shirt. He's free of that. He lives much more in present tense than generally folks do, just like the Dalai Lama recommends. He's very mindful and present, again, like artists are. Again, this is very common in autism, and very common for 1,000 kids like him. So he hops up on a stage and is, well, he loves it. And his capacities, in a way, have been stoked and have grown in the past year and a half since the movie came out, as we go from one theater to the next, to one festival. And he said at the start, he said, you know, when he was around 19 and he was growing in awareness at that point, as to how the world was seeing him. He said to Cornelia, he said, Mom, people see you for who you are, and Dad, they see you for who you are, but they don't see me for who I am. I am more than I appear. I am an unpolished gem, a diamond in the rough. That, of course, is Aladdin. And it was a challenge to us. Cornelia is a writer like I am. She, of course, for 20 years, she's been there as the point person, the captain of caring for Owen. But it was in a way Owen saying, can this change? Can people see me as I am? Mm-hmm. That's all I want. Mm-hmm. And so off we went to say, let's see if we can manage that. Mm-hmm. And it's happened that a world of folks on the spectrum, I think, are being seen more for who they are through really Owen's courage and mm-hmm. Owen's forcefulness.
Yeah.
Yeah, and going to the Academy Awards was, of course, heaven for him because he's got these compensatory skills. Memory, again, like lots of folks on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So he's a walking IMDb. He knows the credits of everyone in the Dolby Theater, like, better than their spouses do, you know. Which, of course, a star loves.
Of course.
That tiny, forgotten credit.
Of course.
The autistic spectrum person remembers.
No, oh, that's funny. Julie is next in Wausau. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Oh, thank you so much for taking my call, and happy retirement, even
Thanks.
Though we're going to miss you terribly. I was so excited when I heard the program because just 2 days ago, we finished a project here in Wausau through Central Wisconsin Children's Theater. I'm a music teacher, and I do vocals, and my daughter is a mentor for a project called the Penguin Project, started by a pediatrician named Dr. Andrew Morgan from Peoria, Illinois, and he started the project to include all special needs kids with any special need or disability to be part of a theater production. And all of the kids that have special needs are artists or leads, and they all are paired with regular ed kids who are on stage in costume, but they don't have any lines. All of the leads and major parts and all the parts go to the special needs kids. And
oh,
we just finished Singing in the Rain this past weekend,
and I
am telling you, I have a million stories
feeling.
about how
I'm happy again.
Kids, you don't have to
thing.
Limit these kids. You if you give them a dance routine and you say we're learning this, they will learn it, and there are no ends to what they can do. And I know the parent wouldn't mind me sharing this, but my favorite story, and I hope you have Kleenex. There's a young man in the show that is 95% nonverbal, but yeah. We gave him lines this year because we knew that he could do it if he worked on it, and he and his dad really worked and really worked. And I said to his parents, I'm so proud of him. He's doing such a great job. And they said his favorite song is Good Morning, and they listened to it in the car, and he does the singing and the dancing in the car. And he walked into his kitchen last week, and looked at his mother and said, Good Morning, Mom.
Oh, wow.
Oof.
And he's never spoken those words before. And his mom said, I could hardly go to work. I thought about it all day long.
Is this Good Morning from the Lego movie?
To what they can do.
I don't know if you heard, Ron. Go ahead, Ron.
Good Morning from the Lego movie?
Oh, no, from Singing in the Rain.
Oh, from Singing in the Rain. Oh, okay. Oh,
yeah.
That's right. That's one of the songs of Singing in the Rain. Well, you know, you're living it. And
it's remarkable.
And boy, it changes you. It changes you when a child summons the enormous energy and capacity, effort, to
to be able to speak. You know, I'll tell you something, you know, more and more I'm realizing it's more akin to Stephen Hawking's not being able to speak than what we have presumed, that there's not beneath that silent surface capacity. And again, that's the big change. And when they, it's like an aria. It's like a, when they speak it, it's the most beautiful sound you've ever heard in your life.
Oh, Jim,
and that's why it has changed the mentors too. I don't know who
that's what we, you know. Yeah.
More to teach regular ed kids the compassion to work with these kids for really no star time of their own is just remarkable. And how they come out of the woodwork and work so hard, I can't get over how proud I am.
Oh, Julie, send pictures if you can.
Thank you.
If you have pictures, it'd be great. We'll put them on our Facebook page.
Oh, I do. Yep. I will send them.
Thank you so much. Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you.
And feel free to continue on this vein, but I want to talk to Ron about a few other things as well.
I am dying to talk about Donald Trump. I've been working for decades. In some ways, Kathleen, the previous books predict and lay the conceptual foundations for much of what we now realize and recognize allowed for the emergence of Donald Trump. And we're in a pickle here. We are in a real pickle in the United States.
So you have asked the question, and I'm wondering how you've been able to answer this, Ron. Who is this guy, Donald Trump? What does he believe?
Yeah.
Who is he?
Yeah,
what does he, what does he believe?
Well, you know, one of the difficulties we find is that Donald Trump believes in a powerful ideology, and it is the ideology of Donald Trump, the idea of Trump. He does not actually have, as far as I can see, strong beliefs in terms of policy, in terms of the direction of America, in terms of things that might be done to help people live fuller lives, which is the role of government to do what it can. He is a kind of elegantly built and some might say diabolically built machine to draw attention to himself. Mm. He thrives, as some public people do, mm-hmm. on the gaze, on people focused on him and his moves and what he'll do next. And something that I found a year and a half ago when he started to rise, and I talked at one point to Corey Lewandowski, his campaign manager at the time, and I started to realize that the thing that's so unique about Trump is something with antecedents that are unknown, visible. Years ago when I was doing stuff for Ted Koppel at ABC, there was a brilliant producer there named Dan Green, who asked me one night, we're out late chatting, he says, why do people watch sports on television? I said, well, you know, I said the traditional things. Well, you know, it's competition, there's winners and losers, you know, all that. He said, no. It's the only thing that occurs on television. Everything else is produced. Mm-hmm. I said, aha. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump occurs on television. And it was one thing during the campaign, and people couldn't take their eyes off him, and he captured my friends, especially in electronic media, especially on television, on cable. And literally, they were the wings that brought him. They're the wind under his wings that brought him to the presidency. Now we're in a new place where this man is on the quarter deck of the world's most powerful nation and running a reality show. Without, as far as I can see, foundations that go more than a few feet into the soil. And these improvisations that come by the hour, I mean, you're getting something at breakfast and something new at lunch, which, of course, is perfect for a reality show values of which he essentially rose and became prominent, are disastrous for the nation and for a democratic republic born of a constitution that is at the heart of the oldest working democracy in the world, the foundation and model for democracies everywhere. And the question now is this fundamental question. Why has this democracy lasted so long, Kathleen? Here's why. Those founding fathers were brilliant men, and they built self-correcting features right into the machine. Those self-correcting features and functions are how we managed to move forward with all manner of twists and turns. My fear is that many of those processes of how we self-correct with the checks and balances, the role of the media, the role of the courts, that for partisan reasons, the will to power by the parties, political parties especially, and it's in their actors, has been such that sand has been thrown in the gears of those machines, and they are not functioning. And if they do not, at this moment, we could be facing some tragic occurrences up ahead. I mean, mind you, we're in what I would call, having covered, three presidents.
Right.
We are in a quiet time now. There are no major international incidents on the landscape at this moment, like ones that are brewing at this point. Nations around the world are waking up to this idea of a changed planet without American leadership in terms of our might and our moral code. And that means they will do what they had done before America rose, which is act in entrepreneurial ways, geopolitically, test borders, test boundaries, try some things that are locked in the bottom drawer, whether it's firing off a missile or crossing a border in an aggressive way. Mm-hmm. And already you see it. You see it in Russia. You see it in North Korea. That's what I fear. And I wrote a book, The 1% Doctrine on the War on Terror. I know the mentality of not just al-Qaeda, which I wrote about in two books, but also al-Qaeda's successors and imitators, ISIS and others. They couldn't have imagined or dreamed of anything that would provide a table setting so advantageous to them as Trump has. Hmm.
You've said that when you contemplate the next 3 years, Ron, you see a possible impeachment, you see World War III, heaven forbid, you see the Kardashian White House.
I do. I mean, I was on Colbert the Thursday before the Tuesday election. And we were doing what you can imagine, Stephen and I riffing about Trump and what's happening. At that point, I was with Michael Moore. I said, I think he's got it. But, you know, I also thought about what he did in that third debate and now what he's doing just about every day in the White House. What did he do? Remember, in that third debate, he would not accede to the will of the American people. You know, Chris Wallace asked him a pointed question of would he abide by the judgments of the American people on Election Day just up ahead. He said, you know, I'll decide that then. I'll keep you in suspense, you know, in his Trumpian way. And at that point, everyone said, oh, he lost the debate, which he actually was doing better in than the previous debates. I said, I couldn't disagree more. He just did something for which we have little context. He just threatened the American people. He said, I've got a mob. I've got a constituency that will follow me just about anywhere at this point. As he said, I could shoot someone in the middle of the road and it would have no consequences. And what is he saying at that moment? I'll decide what I tell them to do. If I want them to burn down your city, they'll burn it down. If I'm going to direct them to any outcome, that's my prerogative. That's not something we have a context for, not pretty much since the Civil War, something we've talked about on our podcast on Freakout and Carry On. In some ways, that's what's happening almost every day now that he actually has power. You know, I think one of the questions now lands right at the feet of largely the Republican majority in Congress as to what this party, this majority, will decide to do. Remember, you know, when I'm a kid, when you're a kid, Kathleen, Richard Nixon, you know, it was Barry Goldwater who arrives and says, after a year of hell with the Watergate scandal, Mr. President, it's time for you to go.
Yes.
I'm leading the party, your party. It's over. And Nixon was out the next day. And I think what's evolving now, and it may continue to evolve or it may reverse or get quashed, but my sense is that there's a dawning clarity and recognition by Republicans to say the fortunes of this man and my fortunes as a member of his party are diverging quickly.
I know,
and
there was
that could end up being salvation, I think, in terms of where we go.
There was a comparison made. I love that you do current events through a historical perspective because we need a sense of history. There was a comparison made in a recent podcast of yours to Benjamin Harrison, who didn't win the popular vote. He said he knew how to make America work again. He put his son in an important position, didn't pay attention to protests. People were starving in the West. And the protests became the Alliance Movement of 1890. We got the populist movement from that and the progressive movement. Do you see that happening as a result of what we're witnessing now, a new kind of progressive movement or not?
Well, I do. I do. I mean, you know, again, you know, we predict as we will, and then we're surprised. But I think history says again and again that at moments in which there's an extreme movement in one direction by one party, and it's both Democrats and Republicans, it's not a party issue, but where people have a moment of recognition as to, no, that's definitely not what I want, there is often soon a reaction, and the pendulum swings back often very, very forcefully. And people recognize, whether it's in the late 1800s for Harrison or now, that politics is a participatory sport. And then they go and say, hey, the people in the system are the sovereigns, and I'm going to exercise that power. You know, I had an interesting encounter with John Lewis.
Did you?
Before Trump arrived. Mm-hmm. Yeah, amazing guy, of course.
I
think really, man, you know, worthy of sainthood in America, the great civil rights icon. And it was actually the day that Eric Garner, the African-American man who was strangled by police, the day that those officers were not indicted and people were protesting on the streets. And Lewis, wise that he has been on our behalf, says, look, Ron, look at what's happening today. People of all races, all creeds, all income levels are taking to the streets on a day when there's many other things they can do and doing it together. And what happened to Eric Garner is a tragedy that, frankly, gets repeated countless times invisibly around America every day. But here they're reacting and saying, I won't stand for this. And they're doing it in unison with might. And I think that is may well be the legacy of this time we are in, of reaction and counter-reaction. And in fact, I don't think it's going to be a strict party divide either. Because there are many Republicans I know and have had sources and subjects who are calling me regularly to say, I am now considering what I must do.
That's interesting. Ron Suskind, our guest, will take phone calls for him, more of them in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network. We go to more phone calls now for Ron Suskind and Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Next caller. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. Two things. The guest, Ron, referred to the founding fathers and how brilliant they were in terms of setting up a self-correcting government. They were also highly educated in classical philosophy, ancient history. They knew what had happened to Greece, Rome, Roman Empire, all the way through. Our leaders today are people today, all we think about is economics and business management. That's one point. We don't have leaders who are intelligent enough to see the dangers ahead. My second point is that very intelligent analysis that we're hearing from Mr. Suskind and others might actually be feeding Trump the ideas that he might not otherwise have formulated, but feed him the ideas that he will go on to exploit.
It's Kurt or Kirk?
Kurt.
Kurt, like, I love you citing the Greeks and the Romans and classical philosophy. Of course, the founders were so-called neoclassicists, and an extraordinary group, as you say, brilliant men who were rooted in a, I would submit, a deeper foundation of thinking and of understanding the human dilemma and human pageant. I think the point that so often we are thinking about economics or material issues, haves and have-nots, and inequality specifically, rather than underlying issues of how a society defines itself, how it makes decisions as to value, what Latin would be virtu, is a real issue. And I think that some of the difficulty that I found on the Democratic side, I interviewed certainly everyone there, including the President Obama, is that maybe there was too much focus on those issues, economic, material, GDP,
mm-hmm.
Rather than how we define ourselves as a people. You know, one of the key moments that was one of clarity for me as I interviewed President Obama in the White House, in the Oval Office in 2011, and he talked about this in a way. He says, you know, Carter, Clinton, and I suffer from what I call the policy wonks disease, that we think they're answers, you know, in these policy provisions that will make all the difference. And he said, you know, the thing that I did as a candidate that I forgot to do as president or didn't find a way to do was the only thing a president can do that no one else can, which is tell a story to the American people of who we are and where we're bound. It seems like the breadth of our national life. It seems like the story of us, the shared national, and I dare say human narrative. He says, I forgot that. I didn't do that as president. I think he's right about that. Mm-hmm. He did it more at the end of his term.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, having written about inequality since my early days at the Wall Street Journal, 1991, I wrote my first story. It is certainly the defining fault line issue, I believe, of this era. It is connected to just about everything we see, including significant populations in the United States, not all in the wide middle, all over the country. We're saying, I'm feeling left behind in this nation. Happiness, our economists tell us, or certainly folks involved in well-being studies, is comparative, very, very much in societies. How am I doing compared to the other folks, the guy next to me? Those huge disparities that have grown up during my lifetime are right at the core of, I think, what is tearing us to shreds. And I, right now, am not seeing anybody who is going at this fault line and structural issues, but it is driving the equation, make no mistake, and Trump has played it with a kind of a capacity that, you know, is instinctive on his part, but effective.
Yeah. We have about a minute left. I'm also thinking about kindness and remembering Kurt Vonnegut's, you know, the world could use more kindness, paraphrasing it, but the lack of kindness, the kind of cruelty, it just makes you, it breaks your heart when you see what's happening to immigrants and what could happen to people who are kicked off health care and the cruel comments that have been made about other human beings, many of whom are heroes, it makes you cringe. We need more kindness.
No, Kathleen, you're right on it. Kindness. It's all that matters. And the fact is, I think people are saying what I'm hearing from Washington and elsewhere, that's not the nation that I see as our best selves.
Right.
And I think ultimately we will self-correct. We will bend toward the sunlight of these ideals. You know, across 20, 30 years now, I have sought the human story.
Yes, and you've done it well, and we're out of time. Ron, thank you so much for being with us. You're wonderful. Thanks.
Well, good luck. Good luck to you, Kathleen,
thanks,
in your journey.
Thank you, and to you as well. Ron Suskind, he has a new podcast, Freak Out and Carry On, from WBUR. It's worth a listen, and all his books are wonderful, as you can tell just by hearing his thoughts. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing the hour, to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Thank you for listening. We'll be with you mañana.